We're delighted to welcome you to a rather unique session in the series the Miller Center has sponsored on science advising to the presidency. We have had, over the last 3.5 years, some 40 people that have met with us and discussed the role of the science advisor to the president. But two things have been missing. One, there are, after all, two branches of government, and we have been encouraged throughout our discussions to consider the fact that the Congress plays a vital role in appropriations, funding, programs that find their way into national policy. And secondly, on a perhaps more humorous note, a certain name has kept cropping up in our discussion. The story is told of the Kennedy administration, and John Kennedy, almost in exasperation, said, who the hell is James Perkins? Because every place he turned, people were recommending the future president of Cornell University to him for an appointment in the Kennedy administration. Evidently, overkill obtained, because James Perkins never did receive an appointment, although he had several advisory roles. But in our discussion, the name of Jack Gibbons has kept coming up in our discussions, of somebody that had been extraordinarily successful in his advice to members of the Congress and to the government at large, agencies and departments. And so we have long hoped that it would be possible to bring the Miller Center project on science advising and Mr. Gibbons together. There's a third reason, and that is that the birthplace of our speaker today is Harrisonburg, Virginia. His Bachelor of Science degree was from Randolph-Macon College. He was ill-advised in actually going on to Duke University to seek his PhD, but in every other respect, he's a true Virginian, and his own family members are practicing medicine at the University of Virginia. He is, as all of you know from our advanced notices, the director of the Office of Technology Assessment. He's held a series of other important appointments with the Federal Energy Administration, with the National Academy of Sciences, with a host of other groups. He's published widely in the field, articles and writings, and we feel privileged indeed that we have an opportunity to correct a deficit in our coverage. One, the omission of a distinguished Virginian, and two, the attention that should be given to the role of the Congress and advice to the Congress in the science advising field. It's a great pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Ken. I'm honored by your introduction. I remind my grandfather once told me that an accolade is somewhat like chewing tobacco. It's okay as long as you don't swallow it. I do appreciate the chance to come to UVA. I almost, one night at Randolph-Macon, I had two applications in front of me. One was to medical school at UVA, and the other was to do physics, and I finally chose the physics half. I'm not sure whether it was the later lady or the tiger that I chose, but I almost made it to UVA. I did enjoy hitchhiking back to Harrisonburg from Ashland through Charlottesville, because we Randolph-Macon fellows could wear t-shirts in the summer, and everyone here had to wear coat and tie, and I was gleefully pacing the streets of Charlottesville. But it is a pleasure to be with you today. I'm also pleased that you invited my colleague, Mr. Bush, to another happening here in town today, and I'm sure he's going to do very well. And I'm particularly honored by your coming to see me instead of Mr. Bush, so I thank you. I do remember that definition of a Virginia aristocrat I guess, well, an aristocrat's known as a family that's been descending a long time, but the definition of a Virginia aristocrat is one that is too poor to paint but too proud to whitewash. So, having worked in government for some years now, I guess I can at least follow that economic trend. But I did learn in an earlier era with the executive branch back in the early 70s when I went to Washington first to work on setting up an energy conservation program in the Nixon years, that it was a very interesting place to be and difficult to learn about from without a direct experience. I learned the meaning of Harry Truman, Harry Truman's comment when he said that if you want a loyal friend in Washington, you better go out and buy a dog. It is a place where knives are sharp, but those of you on the faculty here understand that situation full well. It's also an interesting place in terms of the invisible movement of ideas and information. Bill Baker, who ran the Bell Labs for many years, observed once that Washington was very confusing to a physicist because it's a place where sound travels faster than light. Perhaps that's true, but at least I think the work for the Congress, when I left Washington in 74 after serving in the executive branch, I vowed that if were ever to come back, it would be to some other branch of government. Since I'm not a judge, that only left the legislative branch. Of course, we all know the legislative branch that other branch of government that Mr. Jefferson, morning Mr. Jefferson on the wall there, once said that no man's home and hearth are safe when the legislature is in session. And it is true that Congress has always been the receiver of a lot of comedy, jokes, and the likes, many well-deserved, I must say. Will Rogers was once asked by a friend of his to explain the situation because his friend had said that he had been studying Congress and he found to his dismay that most of those folks up there were thieves and rascals. And Rogers said, well, they're a good cross-section of their constituents, you know, so they're well represented. Rogers also said that, as you know, he made many observations of Congress and the government. He once said that I don't make jokes, I just watch the government and report the facts. And it is a source of a lot of humor, and for good cause, because without humor, I think we would have a lot more despair than we do today. Well, one reason I was interested in going to OTA in just a decade ago was to follow up on a notion that seemed to me quite valid, that the legislative branch, acting in the early 70s, realized that if it were to be able to maintain the separate but equal powers under the Constitution, it had an increasing need for its own expert advice. It felt somewhat overwhelmed by the resources, intellectual and otherwise, of the executive branch. And it created some additional institutional strength to serve its needs, to serve, as it were, a counterpart to the executive branch. Thus, OTA was created in 1972, and very shortly thereafter, the Congressional Budget Office. So those two new institutions complemented the Library of Congress and the General Accounting Office as the four support agencies for the Congress that would operate for both houses and both parties. The purpose of CBO, you know well, it is to examine budget and monetary implications of proposed policies and to rationalize them against the budget and appropriations process. And they serve as sort of a countervailing force to the OMB downtown. And it's interesting to see the arguments that emerge between these two bodies. OTA's role was not so much to look at budgetary impacts in isolation, but to think about the forces of scientific discovery and technological change as they impact not only legislation, but more broadly impact the American people. to understand the application, the implications of the application of technology to a variety of social issues, and to do it in a rather comprehensive way, to look not just at the kicking of the tires, that is, the evaluation of the technology per se, but also its implications, social, economic, political, ethical. It's a remarkable act in that way. It, of course, had the intent of providing Congress with a common resource to serve committees of either house with jurisdiction on issues in a way that could be, as it were, a shared resource to the Congress. Not so much to tell the Congress what they ought to do, but rather what their options are, an attempt to help narrow the debates, to elevate the level of the debate by helping reach stipulation and agreements and consensus on issues as closely as we could, and thus helping sharpen up and define those issues that must be resolved in the adversarial process, which is the heart of the Congress. I think Senator Moynihan summed it up once very well, and he said, in a democratic society, we can all have our own opinions, but we cannot all have our own facts. And OTA's role is to try to help separate out facts from opinions and thus help raise the level of the debate. Of course, it is a rather emboldened experiment because it is quite an adversarial system that operates there. George Bernard Shaw once said that the theory of the adversary system is that if you set two liars to exposing each other, eventually the truth will win out. And of course, we're not quite sure that always happens, but at least it's an interesting idea. How can one interject into that process dispassionate, nonpartisan, unbiased analysis that doesn't even say what ought to happen, it only tells you something about the roadmap that you can pick your own highway from. Anyhow, we've had about a dozen years, almost 15 years now, experience in this business, and I think there are some arguments that our work is used by the committees. We can trace the impacts of our work reasonably well for certain legislative things. Other things, such as especially the most major issues, it's difficult to track your work because it's immersed in a sea of other analyses and other inputs, and it almost doesn't make any sense to try to separate out your own particular actions from the rest. The scope of our work has to be broad. We have to be able to respond to questions involving technology from wherever they come. And they're coming from an increasingly diverse number of committees of House and Senate. We do work for committees rather than for individuals. We typically will undertake work that is requested by both the chairman and the ranking minority member of several committees of jurisdiction, which means that before I even take a proposal to my congressional board, we will have to have done a lot of work of integrating the interests and horse trading terms of reference in our studies with the committees that ultimately will have to be making decisions. But that has a great advantage. It means that from the outset, we will have identified our client very clearly. The clients will have expressed themselves quite specifically about their interests. And therefore, our customers are well identified at the outset. And that's a big help, as you know, in trying to do work in the political realm. We have by virtue of the act, a lot of important strengths. The strengths are a bipartisan board, a comprehensive charge for doing work so that we're not overly narrowly focused in the areas in which we can work. As I mentioned, our client-oriented relationship, our institutional memory by having a small but diverse staff of professionals that gives us a capability of carrying on and retrieving ideas and things that have happened in the past. An orientation, because of the smallness of our group, an orientation to the outside. We reach out and bring in an extraordinary number of people, probably between 5 and 10 times our own staff in terms of numbers each year to assist us with our work. Some of it is by contract, much of it is by advisory panels and critical reviewers and temporary appointments. We do go through a lot of critical review, and except for the constraints of doing classified work, which is a small element of our place, we do a lot of external review all in sunshine, so that by the time we can deliver our work to the Congress, it will have been delivered with a lot of testing in the marketplace of our peers before it goes up there. We do try to develop options rather than tell the Congress what they ought to do, even though sometimes when you make your findings as explicit as you hope and your options as clear as you would hope, that almost de facto becomes a recommendation. And sometimes the members don't like it, sometimes they do. We have to simply lay it before them and let the chips fall where they may. Someone said that, recounted a story of a young man who was asked to write an essay on a great person. And he and his classmates wrote various essays, and he won the prize, and his essay was on Socrates. And it went as follows in toto. Socrates was a great man. He gave advice to other people. He was poisoned. Well, we haven't been poisoned at OTA, but we sometimes are perforce embroiled in a lot of controversial things. We also understand that in delivering our material, we must have a firm foundation of authority in the way we go about our work and in the product we deliver. I brought along a sample of an OTA report, which, as any member of Congress would tell you, is too thick for anybody to really read seriously. But we feel that at the outset, if you're going to take information to these decision makers, there has to be clear evidence traceable back to its source of the information you have in order to have standing. And so our report are unashamedly pretty thick. But we also understand the members aren't going to read this. Their staffers will, those that are concerned. So we do write a summary. The summary leaves out a lot of the source material, but it does give some bottom lines. This is sort of the congressional size. And then we also understand that you need a senator-sized version. And I insist we get it onto one page. They slip onto the back of the page sometimes, but we get it down to one page. Actually, one senator asked me once, he held up a 3x5 card. He said, you know, this is sometimes about all the chance we have to read before we vote on it, on an issue that we are terribly close to. Could you get this down to a 3x5 card? And I said, well, only with very fine print. But we do understand the importance of reducing information to a scale that matches the capability of the decision maker to use it. Lewis Carroll, who not only wrote Alice in Wonderland, was also a good mathematician, once said that there's nothing so worthless as a map that's laid out on the one-to-one scale. And that's true. So we try to get our maps down to the scale that matches the needs of the folks. We also understand that while many of the analyses must be very quantitative and very sophisticated, that we're dealing with decision makers who, many of whom don't have that degree of quantification in their background, and therefore we try to get rid of integral signs and other things that are highly mathematical when we get to our final document. It was told from a reliable source, although I won't quote the source, that President Eisenhower one morning in a briefing was amazed when he was informed that fully half of the American people are below average intelligence. We have to understand that you have to express these things in ways that really match the needs of the listeners. Focus on the client relationship. Well, for a moment, I'd like to turn. I brought along a lot of materials, more than you probably ever really want to carry home, but I brought some materials for you today, you faithful folks who forego seeing the president to come listen to my presentation. But I have done a lot of thinking about the presidency for one reason, I worked over on that side of government for about a year and a half and was in enough cabinet meetings to become totally amazed at how the process works sometimes. It's a place where power draws personalities, power relates from personal relationships, and personal relationships are so strongly affected by proximity that you can almost feel the tension and the mounting of influence as you move 1 foot closer to the executive offices. It's a place, therefore, in which the influence of analysis is sometimes, or is always going to be gauged by how much those personalities are interested in analysis and understand it as a source of power itself. The presidency, under the presidency, therefore, the science advice giving depends very much on the personality of the president and the people closest to him. The Office of Science and Technology, as you know, during the Reagan years, dwindled to about half a dozen people and were never seen or heard from by the time one got to the end of that of those two terms. At the same time, the influence of that office was felt sometimes in very controversial ways in such things as the decision on the Strategic Defense Initiative. On the other hand, when we come to President Bush and the advent of Al Bromley as a science advisor, I think we all can already have a sense that Bromley's presence is going to be a much more pervasive and important factor in White House science and technology decision making. One reason you can sense it is you can see the appointments that have been given to Bromley. His responsibilities now cover not only the present science advisor and the head of OSTP, but Al is also on the national, he's on the domestic council, he's a member of the space council. He has been put on enough councils to keep him, unfortunately, very busy all day long. And I think he wonders how he's going to handle all this, how he's going to juggle all these responsibilities. It also tells you that as responsibilities mount for that person, then the needs for key staffing in that office, people to assist him in his work, become very critical. And it's a matter of some interest and some concern about getting these appointments completed so that Bromley and that office have the requisite capability to act as in the capacities they need to act. That raises a question of the role of the science advisor. And I'd like to make just a couple of observations on that and then we can go to dialogue. If you think about the presidential decisions as influenced by the people around him, that obviously includes his cabinet and people within the inner circle of the White House. If you think about the cabinet members, they are politically and personally loyal to the president. Typically, they've not been in government a long time, or they have been in a variety of jobs in town. That is, they haven't had an in-depth, long-term encounter with the particular agency they represent. So when they come to the president's table as a cabinet meeting, they are basically representing a constituent interest, whether it be the Energy Department or Interior or HHS or others. And the president, therefore, has around him some of his friends and confidants, but they in turn are almost inescapably representing the interests of that department. Or at least that's my thesis. I'd be happy to be argued about this. And the question is, can there be provided through such offices as the Science Advisor's Office some more independent, agency-independent voice that can give the president some advice that complements with an E the advice he's getting from those who are representing certain constituencies within the executive branch? Can a person do this in isolation, or should this person not have some backup capability analytical capability to enable him to do his job better. I think this is a thing that is being wrestled with now, for instance, Ken, in the Carnegie Commission's work on science advice to presidency. That's being actively discussed now. What can you do to complement the existing situation in the White House to give the science advisor a bit more leverage in the responsibilities he has? Finally, I would say, going back to OTA, that one of the problems we have in being client-related is that we have to focus not only on these socio-technical issues, but those issues in the context of the responsibilities and authorities of committees. Frequently, that means you have to divide up a big intertwined problem into some manageable pieces. And as an observer said recently, in doing so, complex and intertwined problems are sliced into manageable but trivial parts. We find that in our work on, for instance, waste management or defense strategy or healthcare strategies. And I think we're bound to find the same thing happening in the White House. The question before us then is, how can you divide up problems into manageable pieces in terms of the way government works and decisions are made, and still at the same time not trivialize the problem while you're at it? I think it is an experiment. OTA is certainly an experiment, and I think the Office of Science Advice in the White House is also an experiment. We are only a couple of decades into this kind of activity within government. A lot of other governments are watching the process. We've had, for instance, in the last 18 months, we've had 14 official visits from the Federal Republic of Germany alone. They're trying to figure out how one can do this in other governmental settings, whether it be centrally planned economies or parliamentary government. And so I think one should think about these as experiments, and I'm grateful that places like the Miller Center are looking carefully at it. It seems to me it has been understudied in terms of the real importance that these activities do play in governance now, and well meriting a careful look by people such as yourselves. When asked what he thought about the French Revolution, Mao Zedong thought for a while and he said, "Well, it's a little early to tell." And I don't think it's too early to be looking carefully at these new agencies within the several branches of government to see whether or not they are being productive in the work they do. And also, I think, very interesting to see whether and how such activities are perhaps only uniquely possible in our form of government vis-a-vis parliamentary governments. End of initial comments, and I thank you for inviting me, and I'm ready to be attacked.
Could I ask the first question? Is there a tension between the service you render in providing options to members of Congress and the pressures to which you're subjected by key legislators who may have various programs? One of your predecessors is quoted as saying that it was true that Senator Kennedy, for instance, had been a vigorous sponsor of the legislation creating OTA, but he also was the first visitor to the office of your predecessor with programs and projects that were based in his own community. How do you sift out this service function as over against the response to political pressures?
Fortunately, we've worked that out, I think, satisfactorily. I think the foremost defense against politicization is the board itself, which is comprised of six senators, half Republicans, half Democrats, and six members of the House, the same way. Chairmanship and vice chairmanship move from House to House and party to party. So there is an explicit balance of party, excuse me, and House representation on the board, and the board is a working board. It must meet with a majority of the members present in order to vote, and that's unlike any other committee of Congress. For instance, yesterday I met with my board and 10 of the 12 members were there. You know, usually if you go to a Senate hearing, there's one senator and then a bunch of witnesses. But in this case, they meet, they are engaged with the work, and they are good at understanding that while they may have extraordinarily different political philosophies, they share a common interest in analysis, and they know that politicization would be the first way to undermine the whole process. So you find Ted Stevens and Mo Udall fighting each other on the floors of House and Senate on the ANWR project, but agreeing as board members that OTA ought to study the ANWR. That's number one. Number two, partly because of some actions taken by my predecessor and also some negotiations I made when I got there 10 years ago, the board explicitly stays out of every personnel decision except the employment of the director. I keep them informed when a very high level, say an assistant director, changes, but I don't ask their permission, that they don't hire. When they started, the board signed off even on secretaries. Third, the appointment of advisory panels to our projects, and there's a separate panel constituted for each project, is totally my responsibility. I inform the board when I'm finished. It's a matter of public record, but the board does not pretend to participate there. If they did, it could quickly become politicized. Finally, the requests, while the board can request a study by the OTA staff, they rarely, if ever, do, because they understand that in that case, they might be, or would likely be, usurping the role of some committee of jurisdiction on that issue. And so almost 100% of our work is actually requested not by the board, but by the committees of jurisdiction. We try very hard and almost always have the request co-signed by the chairman and ranking minority. And the board then simply makes sure that the committees are of jurisdiction and that there is bipartisan interest in the work we're doing. So this series of checks, I think, and balances have enabled us to maintain a strict bipartisan operation. And so you ask, what good does that do in a very partisan process? Well, hopefully, when we've completed an analysis, we will have given and developed and sharpened the best arguments for a variety of perspectives. And if a given member's perspective is not reasonably well represented there, then we haven't done our homework. And so frequently you will find an OTA study being quoted by both sides of the argument. This very frequently happens. But the argument itself is focused by OTA's work having gotten rid of a lot of things that otherwise might be part of the debate. It is something you always have to work at. We'll get requests from time to time to take on something, and we will quickly find out that the request is there not because the member wants the information, but because if OTA were to take it on, he could go to the floor and say, well, OTA is studying this now, so we should hold up our decision until OTA is finished. It's a way of a blocking or delaying way. So we have to understand the political process, but not get swept up into it. And there's a careful line one has to walk there.
Dennis Barnes, who's Vice President for Government Relations at PVA.
Jack, really this follows up the last point you made, because one of the impressions I had from the time I was with the Senate Science Subcommittee was that a problem for OTA is that because you take such a thorough and to some extent a fairly extended view of some of these issues, you sort of go beyond the attention span of the Hill, and that I think it's maybe particularly true on the Senate side, where there are so many things vying for attention. One, which we comment on that, and the other is compare your role with that of the Congressional Research Service, which in many ways is has some cover some similar ground.
Dennis, first of all, it's good to see you. Secondly, good points. Let me speak to the first one first. You're right that the time constants of attention of the committees and the members sometimes is pretty short. I once remember calling on, I guess it was the Foreign Relations Committee, and they basically said, look, we know you've got a lot of big things happening in technology and things are going to change out there, but if it doesn't have to do with something over the next 2 weeks, we can't even think about it. Well, I was a little appalled to say, oh my God, you know, things, that's pretty bad, but it's in fact the case that they are so covered up with the immediacy that the long term is a problem. So first of all, when we communicate with these committees, we try to put the longer term issues in, not so much as trying to talk to them about futures things, but to talk about the future implications of the current present decision being made, putting the future in the context of present decisions. Peter Drucker once said that long-range planning doesn't have to do with future decisions, it has to do with the future present decisions. So we try to do that. Second thing is we try to match, and this is the reason we work with the committees a lot before we start, we try to match the pace of our work and its output with the time needs of the requesting committees. This work took about 18 months, but within 3 months of its outset, we were already testifying and delivering pieces of information to the requesting committees. So we try to match our timeline with the anticipated timeline of need of our clients. And that's a little discomforting to people who lead a life in research in which time is less of an element of importance than in this business. We have difficulty sometimes, therefore, in contracting, because we not only have to contract with a capable person or group, but there has to be a very tight time measure on their product. So what we've tried to do is make our delivery match the time needs of the committees. And that means that if we have a two-year project, sometimes it takes 2 years to really wrestle with an issue, but it means we will probably have four or five deliveries in the course of that 2 years. With respect to CRS, which is the part of the Library of Congress that is organized to meet the short-term requests of any member, any request from any member to the CRS has to be handled. And so they handle thousands of requests every year. It's a valiant bunch of folks. I must say, it's about five times the size of OTA. And they, perforce, must do things that are much less comprehensive, much less thorough, much less critically reviewed by external peers than what OTA is able to do. If there weren't for a CRS, and if those requests came to OTA, we would be out of business in a week, I think. We simply couldn't handle it. So the question is only the adjudication of requests, and we get together monthly between the four agencies, review the work we're doing, and make sure that we are handing off to each other. In fact, there's a lot of horse trading of things these days, and which everyone's overloaded, so you keep trying to pass the request off to the other agency. And I think we found a good complementarity, therefore, a good modus vivendi of the four agencies in that regard.
General Diskin?
As surely you know, actually facts can support opposing opinions. For example, the bottle's half empty and the bottle's half full. Too many cooks spoil the broth, many hands make light work. The best defense is an act of offense, and from Lewis Carroll, tis love that makes the world go round. Oh, I thought it was about everyone minding his own business, and so on. You can really support almost any opinion you want with facts if you do it. Now, with that background, what I'm asking, and since another fact we have put in there is that the most educated and the most objective of human beings can't be entirely objective. That's, now, with all that in mind, are you ever influenced, shall I say, or biased, or whatever you want to call it, toward supporting an opinion, which is related to the facts, although they may actually be opposing?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, is are we ever influenced by the weight of opinion or the degree of consensus among stakeholders? We try to reflect in our studies the extent to which the stakeholders, all of them, weigh on one side or another of an issue. Because one of Congress's problems is that they get testimony from various advocates, and sometimes they're strictly orthogonal, and yet everyone's an expert on this testifying. So we try to give a sense of why these experts disagree with each other. Why is it they come up with such different positions? And along with that, we try to say, to faithfully represent, when the various stakeholders actually do pretty well agree on an issue. In other words, when there is a convergence, and we don't try to hide that and only stick simply to science facts, because most socio-political decisions or issues come up because there isn't that clear an outcome. I mean, it comes to Congress because it's an issue. If it weren't an issue, it probably wouldn't get there. And so we try to faithfully differentiate between what you can concur about or with very strong consensus, or where people strongly disagree, and if so, why. And then try to go from there to laying out a set of options or alternatives that are defensible even in the face of this inherent uncertainty in argumentation. It's not easy, and that's why we feel that a lot of external criticism and review is important on the information before we try to bring it to the members' attention.
Jack, you did well with a general. We'd like to see how you do with an international financier. Henry Theobar?
To what extent do your people or your contract people collaborate with the presidential advisory group?
Good question. We are very active at the working level within the departments and the national laboratories and other folks downtown. The place, we don't have laboratories, and we shouldn't have. We depend on a lot of help at the data level in our collegial relationships, not only with the executive branch agencies, but with industry and academia. The place we separate from downtown is when one moves from interpretation of data toward a conclusions about what the data tell you, and what your options are that come out of that. If you're in the executive branch, that, as you move toward the political decision process, you move more and more to the sequestering and political filtering of that information, per force, because you're working for the president. In our situation, we're working for both parties, and therefore we're working for Congress, but not for any one of the particular positions. That gives us a real advantage, because we can be a lot more honest about what we're saying, because it doesn't have to be filtered by a political filter that must happen if you're in the executive branch. So we can come to very different conclusions. For example, the White House reported on the Clean Air Act amendments here in recent weeks with a good deal of enthusiasm about the extent to which these amendments would bring a number of American cities finally under compliance for ozone and hydrocarbons and other air contaminants. Beginning with the same data, but carrying the analysis a little bit further, and I think being a little bit more sanguine about it, we showed that the claims of the administration were grossly over-optimistic, and in fact, at very best, you'd get half the cities under compliance with these methods. So it's a bit of a tempering of what the data tell you, even though we start from the same data sets. I think somewhat similar on the work we did on General on the defense technology base. And I'd be happy to leave you the thick report, in which we pointed out that more and more defense technology is depending on civilian technologies and on internationally available foreign technologies, and the extent to which one can hope to block the movement of some of these defense-relevant technologies through some of our export controls is very questionable. And so we were in a tussle with the White House on that. We were in a very bitter struggle with the White House on the interpretation of SDI technology, and on underground testing verification methods. So we all had the same data to start with, but we certainly came out with very different conclusions at the end.
Dr. Kenneth Crispell, who was vice president for many years of health affairs here and the author of a pioneering study on the health of presidents.
I have a wonderful friend who ran for governor of Virginia, and he visited Southwest Virginia, with which you're acquainted, and the fine old gentleman asked him what his beliefs were, and he said, sort of the middle of the road. And the old man said, that's a good place to get killed.
The yellow stripes and chickens, I think.
No, I'd like to go back and ask you a couple of questions, if I could. I go way back to Lister Hill and Jim Chapman and Colin McLeod and all those people. During the era in which I was involved, the trust was full for health.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've ever had time to look up Lister Hill's history, but...
extraordinary.
You know, he's a frustrated physician in his three generations before. He's named after the famous English surgeon. Jim Shannon, director of NIH, would tell Lister Hill what he needed.
In fact, he always had a little extra something in his briefcase when he was on the hill.
And Jim was taking care of Daddario, his patient, in the house.
I hadn't realized that.
And all that happened was that Lister would call Jim and say, I don't think you asked for enough. Now, the same thing happened with Maggie, with Magnuson. You know, they call the University of Washington the University of Maggieville because he started, when he started as chairman of the finance committee. I'm bringing up these two legends to say, I don't see how you protect yourself from these very powerful people unless they want protection. And my question is one of your functions, you can be off the record if you want, is one of your functions to protect some of these stars from their constituents by asking you for an opinion?
I
don't answer unless you want.
Well, Madison and Jefferson talked about the armamenture of knowledge and facts and wisdom, and I think the extent to which we can help the, I won't name names at this point, but just 3 days ago we delivered a document to one of our, turns out he's a board member, but also a very powerful member of the Senate. And the very next day, one of his distinguished colleagues asked him for support on a certain bill. Had he not had our report in hand, fortuitously, just 24 hours ahead, he would have been inclined to go with his colleague. But our report made it so clear to him that that would have been unwise that he declined to go along with his colleague. So they do listen every now and then. They do choose to look at the work and let it guide their decision making. I think the heyday of health with Hill and Burton and others has transformed to a much less salubrious situation in which these folks are struggling mightily with zero-sum game instead of an infinite-sum game.
Well, a minus game.
And if anything, a descending-sum game. And that has put a lot more break on the business of favoritism. Although it's still rampant, as you know, in science policy, this business of how one can judiciously and equitably distribute the science funds, which is the new pork. Maybe we'll go back to infrastructure one of these days. But how one can judiciously and equitably do this and be responsive to your own constituents back home is a tough one. And we've seen some, what Frank Press has, I think, adequately described as improper manipulations of the course of scientific support simply because of this. So we're not over it, but it's been enormously tempered by the budget situation.
Dr. Nod Alberts, who was chairman of psychiatry at Chicago for many years and then professor of psychiatry at UVA.
I wondered how you distribute your energies as far as numbers of projects or staff time and so on between defense issues on the one hand and transportation, environment, health, other issues on the other.
Good question, Dr. Aldrich. I should have paid you in advance because I have a little description of OTA here. We try to organize our agency so that it can move its resources to the areas that Congress sees as their major areas of concern. But at the same time, we want to hold on to some degree of institutional memory. So we organized ourselves in 9 program areas, each program being a somewhat flexible, broadly based or a group of about 15 to 20 people. For instance, all of our health work is centered in mostly in a so-called health program, which is human health issues, and then very closely associated with it is a new program in biotechnology, which also includes some health issues. I try to divide, first of all, by making these into 9 programs, it's a workable size unit for quality control and efficiency. Secondly, I try to make them flexible enough that you can move projects across their interfaces relatively well. You can even do joint ventures on a given project, such as global warming is an issue that cuts across about 3 or 4 of our programs. I divide my budget arbitrarily into the overhead, paying the rent, as it were, and then into 3 chunks. And each chunk goes into one of these 3 divisions of OTA. That's more for a reason of manageability than it is because I feel that the sum of each of these programs ought to be exactly the same as the sum of each of the other 3 programs. That way we manage to spread our work out, but with flexibility amongst the programs, it means all 9 are quite busy all the time. So it's our attempt to keep a flexibility within the agency, an institutional memory at the same time of some of these major socio-technical areas. And over time, the name of a program will change and we will shift. For example, the energy program 5 years ago was just energy. It became energy and materials when we formed a group called Industry, Technology, and Employment, because international trade and competitiveness issues were rising so fast and technology transfer, that we created a new program and merged materials and energy into a single program. So we try to have that flexibility, but still hold on to institutional memory. Psychologically, interestingly enough, we find that dividing responsibility out about 3, a factor of 3 at each level within the agencies, 1 director, 3 assistant directors, and each under each of those 3 programs, is operationally a pretty good way to go. It's a way to keep quality control, institutional memory, and a size that is an appropriate for intensive, high-quality work.
God made the same discovery.
I thought we were in 2 pieces.
Professor Kretzinger, formerly chairman of biology.
I want to ask you 2 brief questions. First, would you want to have the authority to initiate studies? As I understand, you responded to requests. And secondly, I wanted to ask you about staffing. We're often on the faculty in the position of advising students, undergraduate and graduate students, about their training, their prospects. What is the quality of staff that you can recruit? What sort of training backgrounds would you like to see them have with a standard PhD with, you know, doing a research problem? Is that an optimal background for the people who work with you?
The self-initiation is possible under our act. The board can approve our undertaking major studies, and incidentally I have authority for what we call small special responses. Currently that means any project up to above $50,000 I can authorize internally. Although I insist that those also be requested by committees of jurisdiction. But the board can also request that I undertake work, and every now and then they do it. For example, they will request that they requested that we did some defense work that they knew that the Armed Services Committees wanted but didn't want to ask for it. And I can tell you why later on. But and the third way the board can approve work is if I recommend that we undertake it. I have done it on occasion, but rarely, because I feel that if we can't convince or aren't approached by the committees of jurisdiction on an issue, then maybe it isn't something we should be spending a lot of time and effort on. We have done it. For instance, we did a study on world population growth and fertility-related technologies because we knew it was important that Congress generally was interested in it, but no one wanted to ask for it. And so I recommended it to the board, and they took it on. So I think the capability of doing that is important, but it must be used very judiciously. Staff. We have found that, incidentally, our staff is about half natural science, engineering, medicine, and half economics, political, social science, law, ethics, other disciplines. And they're organized in interdisciplinary, problem-focused way. We don't have a division of social scientists. They're all immersed in these problem-focused program areas. We find that our best people come from a variety of backgrounds, but typically they have gone through the crucible of disciplinary training and testing and research, original research. They need to be quite capable in self-expression, whether it be oral or written. They need to have a propensity to want to understand other languages, that is, the language of economics if they're an engineer, or of law if they're in medicine and the like, and be interested in working on problems under the kinds of time pressures that are inherent in this business. We find mixed disciplinary backgrounds helpful. For instance, we have a couple of people who have both law and medicine degrees, and that's very helpful as they work on medicine and as it relates to national health issues. We find folks who have gone through, say, engineering and then public policy at the JFK School or at Stanford or at CMU or other places are very helpful because they've already learned some other languages and have a variety of tools. But we are not interested in someone who just has a degree in public policy, because that doesn't somehow relate very well to us in terms of identifiable specific tools that are useful in the work. I do find it very enlightening to have this mix of disciplines within the place, though. It's really fun. It's nice to be in an institution in which you have to chase people home at midnight instead of looking at whether they clocked out on time.
One more question. Lauren, do you have any questions of public administration, governmental process?
Well,
Lauren Henry was a longtime member of the Government and Foreign Affairs Department and then dean at Virginia Commonwealth.
Well, you have drawn some distinctions between the way the OTA works and the way the Advisory Mechanism of the President works. But let me sort of push that on a level. Would the President be well advised or well served if he had an institutional capability of the size and diversity and modus operandi of OTA?
It's a critical question. In fact, it's a question that this Carnegie Commission is presently addressing expressly. And I've been, it's been fun to work with that commission on that question. I think when you get within the White House, you're really into the decision-making process. So it's not there that one would expect or even hope to have such analytical work carried out. You need to be, as we said the other day, about six blocks away. That is, within a 10 or 15 minute walk, but not much closer, to stay out of the firefight. But what we are beginning to think is an identifiable need is to have a group perhaps 6 blocks away, somewhat like OTA, and some people said, well, why not, you know, make OTA something that could do both. But a group that offline develops, gets at the data, does critical analysis, synthesizes the data, gets it into a format that's utilitarian to the decision maker, lays out the options in a way that is can be rapidly assimilated, and then inside the White House you make the political decisions, or you make the recommendations for the president. In other words, the outside group doesn't make recommendations, it develops options. A group within the White House, the domestic council elects, or the OSTP, make the recommendations to the president. That has to be done in camera, and then it goes forward. But there seems to be missing that element, that feedstock of careful analytical work, that's still there's a paucity in the executive branch.
My comment that the kind of an activity you described corresponds almost precisely to the original formulation of the role of the Bureau of the Budget, which has recent years increasingly become drawn into the vortex of White House decision making and political choice.
That's quite correct, and it may be by drawn into a vacuum of some other alternative, but it's a point I've tried to make in the book Bill Golden edited, that OMB has played that role and others have played a role, and I'm not sure that's the best role for them. They wonder too. But I think your question is very much on target and timely.
Professor Bromley, who's the new science advisor to the president, has been gracious enough to say that he received some of his education for his new job from his participation on the Miller Center Commission on science advising to the president. We today have received a great deal of education at the University of Virginia on the role of the head of the Office of Technology Assessment to the Congress, and in that respect, and with great appreciation, we want to thank you for having been our guest, Dr. Gibbons.
Thank you very much. Before you leave, I should tell you, I